Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm really excited today, not just because I'm recording with Charlie, but because we have an absolutely amazing guest with us. Who have we got on, Charlie? Tell us.
We are very lucky today. We have got Dr. Eilish Gregory with us today. Now, she is a doctor of early modern British history. Yes, yes. We're going early modern, we're going 17th century, so that's why I'm here. She's also a postdoctoral research associate at the Royal Historical Society, so we are getting some quality guests today, Alina. Eilish has held research fellowships at the Folger Shakespeare Library, at Durham University and at Marsh's Library, and she teaches at the University of Reading. She's on today because her book, Catholics During the English Revolution, 1642 to 1660, Politics, Sequestration and Loyalty, was published by Boydell Press in March, and she's very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about it today. So hello, Eilish.
Hello, Charlotte. Hello, Alina. Thank you so much for having me on today.
I'm really looking forward to this. Do you know why? There's a reason behind this, because you have an eidetic memory and you're going to teach me something.
Well, I'll do my best.
So we're going to learn a bit about kings and queens. It's kind of sad that I don't know this. I will learn. One day I will learn this time period. I promise you.
So we were joking that Alina needs to get the special ruler that I'm sure many of our listeners have picked up either for themselves or for a friend at one of the many amazing museums we have around the country. And it is the ruler that has every single monarch of Great Britain listed down the ruler and the date that they came to the throne. So the joke is here that Eilish has a very, very special talent to share with us.
For your listeners, I've just turned Charlotte and Lee before we started that since I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, I've known all the dates of the kings and queens of Britain from 1066 to the present day off by heart. And it wasn't down to me memorising them. I just have this memory that's like a sponge sometimes. so it was great when I was doing like periodic tables for GCSE chemistry and stuff like that. Wasn't so good for practical things like maths and everything.
Oh, amazing. This is great. Okay, so should we test her, Alina? What do you think?
Do you know what? I think you're going to have to test her because I have no idea where we're going with this.
Because I have the ruler. Okay, we'll start with an easy one. King Richard III.
1483 to 1485.
Awesome. Okay. King Edward IV.
Well, this is an interesting one because he was king from 1461 to 1470 and then 1471 to 1483.
Amazing. Okay, so I was just doing my favourite Plantagenet there. Okay, so who should we have? John.
King John was 1199 until 1216.
Gosh, you are incredible. Okay, because everyone else is going to be getting very, very bored. Unless they're playing along at home, let's have this one. King Charles II.
1660 to 1685. Though, as an added bonus to add to that, lots of acts of Parliament in the early modern period would date from when Charles I had his head chopped off in 1649. So a lot of the illegal stuff would actually be from 1649 to 1685. But for continuity purposes, most things just go from 1660 to 1685 when you got the actual crown back on his head.
Awesome. I'm with you. I'm going from 1649 on that one, but just to be controversial and to annoy all our Commonwealth listeners. So we are going to be talking a bit about the Civil War today. So very, very interesting time that a lot of people have been very put off from learning at school. I think it's a really exciting time, but we should perhaps begin before the Civil War. So we're going to be talking about the situation for Catholics. What was the situation for Catholics like before the Civil War? Because I know that anti-Catholic penal laws weren't exactly a 17th century invention. So where did Catholics and their estates stand at that time?
Thank you. So as you just pointed out, it wasn't a new thing that appeared out of nowhere. So for the position for Catholics, that since the Reformation in the 16th century, so going back a century before, Catholics had been this had been in a very awkward situation in Britain for having gone from a majority religion to a minority religion. And so when Elizabeth came to the throne after her sister, the Catholic Mary I, died in 1558, Catholics were supposed to follow the established Church of England and to conform to Protestantism. And so they weren't punished initially for the first 3 years, even though they could be presented for not going to church and they could be fined. But we don't really see any legislation regarding their property and estates until around the 1580s. And that's when we start seeing the Jesuit missions coming to England to try and get Catholicism moving again as such. And obviously this is a big political threat to the Church of England and to Elizabeth's throne, because obviously Elizabeth had been declared a bastard, so she'd been declared illegitimate, and they were worried that the Catholics could potentially try and overthrow her, like had happened in other places in Europe at the time. And so what they decided to do was they decided to punish Catholics for non-church attendance by sequestering their property. So that's confiscating their property. So that's their houses, their land, their estates, their personal goods. So, you know, it could be their crockery, it could be their libraries, it could be anything like that. And so they'd have those things confiscated from them. But in order to get it back, they had to not, you know, to conform and go to church, or they had to pay a fine based on the value of the estates. And that was normally about 2/3 of the value. Although sometimes you can get different rates depending on, you know, your status, your gender, that sort of thing. So it could be like a tenth or something like that, or if you've got dependents. And so until you pay that fine, you couldn't get your property back. And we started to see it change as well in the early 17th century. So after the gunpowder plot in 1685, James I brings in this legislation in 1606 to try and deal with the Catholic threat, because obviously they, you know, they potentially nearly blew them up in 1605. And so what they decided to do was that not only did Catholics have to be, you know, could be sequestered and have to pay fines based on their value of estates and fines not going to church, that they also had to swear an oath of allegiance to the king and to his authority, and that the Pope had no jurisdiction over Catholics in England, which obviously created some problems for Catholics. And this is a thing that we see come up quite a lot in the Civil War. And so you see this sequestration system in force for many decades before the Civil War. And so you have this system of sequestration compounding happening, where estates were sequestered and then fines, the compounding fines, were paid up so Catholics could have their properties back and pretty much be technically left alone by local officials and others. And it was as an acknowledgement that they were being punished for not conforming, but be left well alone once they paid up their fines and just generally carried on behaving relatively well after that. So that was pretty much the situation before 1642.
Well, I think a lot of us are all now completely freaking out at the idea that we could have our books taken away for not behaving and not towing the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Did these anti-Catholic laws, did they kind of flare up at various times? Because you mentioned the gunpowder plot, so I'm guessing there was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction after that.
Yes, definitely. So, yes, 1605-6 is when you start to see it really clamping up, and in the few years after that. Because obviously people thought that, you know, after this plotting had been going on, that there could be other secret underground ones happening. And every time there was a threat, you know, like, because I think what we forget sometimes is it's not just a domestic threat in, you know, in England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, but it's also an international threat. So if things are happening on the continent as well, that has repercussions as well. And so the 30 Years' War, from 1618 to 48, you start to see some bubbling tensions about the Catholic situation, like could this happen in England as well? But what's really interesting was that during the Spanish match in the early 1620s, when James I was trying to negotiate with Spain for his son and heir, Charles I, the future Charles I, to marry the Spanish Infanta, you see the penalty of sequestration pretty much almost lifted up in some respects, in that Catholics weren't being presented as much in the local quarters, you know, the assizes or the quarter sessions. And sequestration is not as highly utilised. So you start to see that they're trying to, because they're trying to do that to try and win the, you know, to get the Spanish on side to get the marriage negotiation sorted. So you see that. But what's really interesting is that in the 1630s, bearing in mind Charles I has his personal rule where he's ruling about Parliament for 11 years and he has a Spanish Catholic, not Spanish, a French Catholic wife, Henrietta Maria, he really ramps up using sequestration compounding as a means to target Catholics, whether they're rich or poor. Because normally before, you had to have a bit of property to be sequestered. You know, Catholics could be fined for not, of all states, status could be fined for not going to church. You really start to see it clamped up in the 1630s because he needed to raise money. So it became a much more like well-oiled machine, but designed to really reap in the money. So he wasn't really on the side of Catholics really, because he saw it as almost like a like an extra like money bank as such to get money off Catholics.
Gosh, because that's really interesting. Cause in the run up to the Civil War, Henrietta Maria is very much used as this kind of talisman for the evil counselors and the Catholic influence on the king, isn't she? So that it really wasn't, he wasn't giving Catholics a good deal. Everyone was getting a bad deal.
Yeah, and so, I mean, there were some Catholics who were given exemptions. And there's an example I used in the book of a man called John Carroll who had actually been given a special exemption in the 1630s. But normally you have to have a bit of money and have a bit of influence to get those types of exemptions. But yeah, it's quite interesting that, you know, obviously there were Catholics being favoured in the court in the 1630s, especially in Henrietta Maria's circle and the big Catholic conversions of people like Sir Kenelm Digby and others. But but Catholics are still being, you know, financially squeezed in a way with compounding and sequestration. So it's a very weird situation for Catholics in this period.
Gosh, they can't have known where they were standing from one minute to the next.
Yeah.
I find this very interesting with the whole idea of religion and politics and it all being interwoven. You've already mentioned to us what sequestration is, but how does Parliament actually decide to use these powers?
Is this during the Civil War, when the Civil War breaks out, do you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so obviously when the war breaks out in the summer of 1642, Parliament is obviously trying to work out what, you know, trying to deal on different fronts. So obviously they're trying to establish the fact that, you know, the king's just declared war on them, but also they're trying to use this sort of rhetoric that, you know, the king has been influenced, has been badly advised by evil counsellors, you know, the same old rhetoric that you hear across the centuries. It's always down to bad counselling by your close-knit circle. So initially they were, Parliament decided to try and target those who they believed to be the causes of the Civil War breaking out, of the English Revolution breaking out. And so they're not really targeting Catholics as such. They're targeting those who they deem to be popish, which is normally tied with Catholicism, but it's those who are politically motivated to try and usurp the true reformed Protestant religion. And so in their eyes at this time, it's figures like the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, and the bishops, and those who had, you know, used popery in the churches in the 1630s when they're the beauty of holiness as such. And so when they're really redoing the churches up as such, because they've been sort of left to disrepair in some places, and so they believe that by revamping some of the churches and just giving a bit of, you know, love and care and repainting stuff and changing the altar position stuff, that was popery, that's going back to the old Catholic ways. And so they were targeting people like that, and they were also targeting those who they were believed to, you know, supporting the king and not supporting Parliament's liberties and the true Protestant religion. And we have to think about just a few months before the Civil War broke out in January 1648. This is when Charles I had attempted to arrest 5 MPs in Parliament, which is why today the Queen cannot go in the House of Commons. She can go in the House of Lords when she opens Parliament, but she cannot go in the House of Commons. No royal can go in there because of what Charles I did.
Yeah. She has to knock.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I never even knew that.
Yeah, I mean, I found out a couple of years ago when I was teaching that when the Queen opens Parliament, she has to, you know, get dressed up in the room in front of the death warrant of Charles I. I think it's a bit of a grim reminder of what happens if you overstep your powers as such, like Charles I did. And so this is the situation that Parliament's dealing with, is that they're dealing with people who they think are acting in an arbitrary, popish, absolutist way as such. And so they're punishing, so the first several months, that these are the people who they're targeting. They're not necessarily targeting Catholics as much. But after lots of negotiations and different acts and bills going through and ordinances, they decide to, in March 1648, after loads of, you know, readings and everything, to target archbishops, bishops, deans and chapters, target royalists, and those who they deem to be popish, but they also include Catholics in there. But so there's this, so it becomes a much more inclusive legislation, whereas before it targeted those who were deemed popish recusants and recusants. This time it's including a much bigger body of people, which is why there's over 265 volumes of compounding petitions in the National Archives for this reason. It's because it suddenly includes a lot more people, whereas before it just, you know, included a population of which people estimate between 5 to 10% of the population of Catholics, and suddenly that's thousands of people being sequestered.
Gosh. So do you think that what happened at this point was that effectively Catholicism and just practicing Catholics in their own homes were lumped in with this sort of fear of arbitrary rule, that they were going after Lord and the deacons and that sort of part of the Church of England with?
I think they would have definitely felt it was a very different system and situation to one they'd been in before. This is the problem with the period sometimes, is the word Catholicism and popery gets interchanged so much that it meant different things to different people. And so they sometimes if you were called a papist at the time, then normally meant you were Catholic, but then people could use it to attack you politically as well. Or, you know, you're being too popish. And so Catholics probably were quite used to that, but suddenly to be lumped in with these other groups meant that they probably felt that this was a very, very different situation to what they dealt with before.
Gosh. So what did this mean for the Catholics who were used to sequestering and compounding under the old system? How did they adapt to what Parliament were doing at this time? Or could they just say, do you know what, we're used to an old system, we're not having a new one, we refuse?
They pretty much had to adapt if they wanted to get their estates back. And what's really fascinating with the English Revolutionary period, and this is why people should study the English Revolutionary period in general much more, is that this coincides with the lapsing of the Printing Act in 1642, which not only means there's an explosion of all these printed sources coming out, you know, with all these pamphleteer writings and everything like that, but it also means there's a lot more parliamentary acts and ordinances being printed and orders. And so petitioners, whether you're Catholic or you're, or a royalist or anything like that, you can actually learn what the process was about, the new process. So you could actually pay for the new sequestration ordinance and know what the terms and conditions are, you know, what you're going to be sequestered for, what do you need to do to get your property and estates back. And if you've been, you know, sequestered because you were caught up in a siege in a royalist garrison, for example, it will tell you who's included and who's excluded from being allowed to, you know, compound for their estates and on what terms they can do that. And you, especially in the 1650s and 1640s, you really see Catholics reference and delinquents referencing these specific acts and ordinances and orders to compound their estates. So they say, so sometimes you'll get a Catholic saying, or a delinquent saying, I'm sequestering, you know, I'm compounding under the terms of the Articles of Newark. So it will say where they've been captured, for example. And sometimes they'll say under this Act passed 1651, I'm entitled to X, Y, and Z. So it's really, really fascinating. So they probably weren't happy that they had to learn a new system, because you wouldn't be, because, you know, you're used to a system that had been, you know, going for quite a long time. And suddenly having to learn a new system would have been not only complicated for those who'd never been sequestered before, but it's going to be complicated for those who'd been, you know, compounding for estates for a long, long time, but can suddenly find themselves charged not only for recusancy, but they can be charged for what they say, royalist delinquency or papist delinquency or delinquency. So again, you see all these interchangeable terms being used. And so it became a lot more complicated for everyone, but particularly Catholics, just because they had been sequestered and compounding in that process before.
Gosh.
Look, talking to a 20th century historian here. Okay, I'm going to bring it up.
History, she calls it.
modern day politics.
Yesterday.
Exactly. Can you explain this to me? I mean, how did the Catholics frame their petitions to get the best deal? Because that's what you want. You want the best deal from Parliament for their estates.
Yeah, well, exactly. What's really fascinating, so I've looked at hundreds and hundreds of petitions, mainly obviously from Catholics, as that's what the book's on. But obviously, I've also looked at other delinquent ones as well. So they all follow pretty much the same pattern. So you'll say, you know, I am such and such. So, for example, I could say, you know, the John Savage Earl Rivers, for example. And you'll say your status, whether you're a gentleman, a peer, yeoman, whatever. And then you'll say what you've been sequestered for. So it could be residency, papist delinquency, etc. And then it'll say why you think you should be allowed to compound. So whether it's because you were proclaiming your innocence, or you know you had been fighting for the king, but you've seen the error of your ways pretty much, and then you're a loyal citizen of part, you know, for Parliament. And then you'll normally say on the next part what things you've done in order to compound for your estates, whether you paid the first half of the fine, which is known as the moiety, or you know you swore specific oaths of allegiance to Parliament, whether it's the negative oath, the oath of abjuration, the protestation. There's so many different oaths floating around at this point, so you normally have to say which ones you've done. And then you normally have to have the evidence to back that up with, whether it's a certificate from those who witnessed you swearing these oaths or someone confirming that you've paid the fine. And then you submit that, and then you hope that they will let you officially compound as such. And normally you had to do this in a place called the Committee for Compounding in London. So normally when the process started, you would submit your first petition as such to the County Sequestration Committee where you lived, or normally sometimes where you were captured. Normally it's going to be in your home county as such, because normally that's where you're found when you're captured. And then it again gets sent to London, and then you have to actually go to London to present your case. And then that's where you hopefully to compound for your estates. And so that's pretty much how all the petitions, by and large, follow the same formula across the 1640s and 1650s. So it was always really fascinating to see how they changed. So when there was one, you know, you get the occasional one where it's not quite in that form, it is quite interesting, but it was very rare for that to happen. So pretty much it all followed the same structure, who they were, why they were, you know, what they were sequestered for, why they believe they should be allowed to compound, and what they had done in order to, you know, to prove that they should be allowed to compound.
Gosh, this must be the most fascinating bunch of archives to get in, not just from the point of view of finding out who was what, who was where, who owned what, but also this wonderful sort of petitioning for yourself, and oh no, I wasn't really doing that, and oh, I'm being really good now, and I'm going to behave, and I've seen the error of my ways. How long could you just lose yourself in all of that documentation?
Quite easily. And because what I did for the book was not only did I look at the Committee for Compounding Petitions and the sequestration order books in Kew in the National Archives, but I also went, I had quite a lot of case studies, you probably saw in the book, where so I went to a lot of the county record offices or the personal family papers as well. So I was traveling across the country checking it. And what's really fascinating is sometimes you'll get actual copies of the petitions that you see in Kew also in the county record office. So it was really nice to see if, first of all, if they replicated it correctly, but also if things have added extra bits or anything like that. And it was really, really fascinating to try and see, to follow the paper trail across the years, because it wasn't like it was done and dusted in a few months. Sometimes these things will go on for years. And so it was really fascinating to see that progress go along, and different people appearing or not appearing, you know, and how, and how these things just dragged on for a long time. So you can see, really see the long-term effects this will have on an individual and a family as a whole. So I loved it. I still love looking at sexually compounding petitions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could only see the looks on these two ladies' faces right now. Okay, Charlie is like, oh my God, this is so amazing.
I am. I find it completely riveting because, you know, my area, I mean, I love the Civil War. I think more people should know about it. My area is a little bit later and during the Restoration. And of course, there are so many interesting Catholic figures, whether they are open or covert in their Catholicism, and you fall in love with the family and you realize that there's one couple and all three of their sons end up in Rome, and you think, oh, of course they were a Catholic family, and you look back and you realize, yep, they had secret priest holes, and you can't help it, can you, Eilish?
You become quite attached to them because they become quite real and personal to you. And when something bad happens to them, you actually really feel it, even though it happened, you know, centuries ago.
Exactly. Oh, we're total nerds. So, I mean, you forget that people, despite it being a very long time ago, were in fact human people with lives and concerns. So what were the relationships like between ordinary Catholics and ordinary Protestants at the time during the Civil War? Was it beef on the streets, or did everyone just get along? Or
Well, as you can imagine, with most time periods, it's not quite as straightforward as you think. Answer-wise, because obviously sometimes there's that perception of like, oh, because it's Catholics versus Protestants, you know, that they're going to be clashing, you know, almost like a muskets at dawn type of behaviour.
A West Side Story, yeah.
Yeah, you know, your two houses and all that. But no, what's always been quite fascinating, especially when I was doing the preliminary research to this, is that, as you can imagine, even today, you trust those who have been around in your area for a long time. So so you get a lot of Catholics in local communities getting on incredibly well with their Protestant neighbours and with Protestant officials, because even though they're following the wrong religion as such, you know, as long as they live quietly and they're not trying to cause trouble, you know, they participate in their society, they're going to be getting along quite fine with them. It's only those who come in from nowhere, the aliens, as they get dubbed in this period. That's when you get suspicious, like, well, who are they? Do we trust them? What are they doing? Are they going to cause, you know, trouble? And so actually, even before the Civil War broke out, you would sometimes get Protestants who would either overlook things or not represent their Catholic neighbours as much at local sizes. And sometimes you'd even get Catholics not having to pay such a higher fine for not being, you know, for going to church. Because normally you had to pay a certain amount of money per week. But once it reached 4 weeks continuously of not going to church, for example, you had to pay £20 a month fine, which obviously is going to cripple you in this time period. And so sometimes what they would do, some local officials, that they would present the Catholics for 3 weeks and then not present them for the following week. And then so they'd pay like 20 pence a month, or something along those lines. I can't remember what the exact pence was per month. But basically, pence per month versus £20 a month is going to make a massive difference.
Yeah. So you can almost game the system.
Yeah. because at the end of the day, especially for some officials, you know, you want to punish them, but you don't want to literally ruin them. Because at the end of the day, especially for some officials, you're going to lose your cash cow as well. You don't want to fine them so much they're not going. You're not going to be able to, you know, get money out of Catholics on a regular basis. For some cynical ones, and so you get this position in the Civil War where. I mean, obviously, you're not going to get good relationships with every place. So obviously, if you've got long-standing feuds, that's not going to work very well. Because they're the ones that are going to target you. But during the Civil War and the interregnum periods, it's really fascinating in that you still see this relationship forged quite well in some communities where officials treated Catholics courteously And, you know, they still had, I mean, even those who had to, you know, sequester Catholics or report them, you know, they would actually apologise for it. I mean, there's a really lovely example I found for Mary Savage and the Rivers family in Suffolk and in Essex, where during the, it's not Mary Savage, it's Penelope Gage. Sorry, there is a Mary Savage I looked at as well. This is the problem when you've got so many different intermarriages going along. You've got Savages, Gages, but no, it's Penelope Gage. I should have that just as a correction there. So just before the English Revolution broke out, because of the Irish Rebellion that happened in 1641, which for those of you who aren't so aware, was when there was a big uprising in Ireland where hundreds, potentially thousands of Protestants were massacred by Catholics, and they feared this could happen in England. And so what happened is that there was orders going around for people's properties to be searched, you know, for those suspected or known to be Catholics, to have their, you know, property searched for weapons and have it taken away from them. And what had happened in the correspondence you can see of the Gage family is that once someone who ended up becoming her third husband, I think, came and warned her that the officials were coming to confiscate the weapons late at night, like midnight raid as such. And they turned up, confiscated the weapons. You know, she said, you know, they're of the old, you know, the antique use. You know, they haven't been used for several decades. They're not going to do any harm to anyone, sort of thing. But they actually apologised. They said, you know, we've been told we've got to do this, but we'll take good care of them. We won't damage your weapons. and they actually wrote a letter to the mother-in-law, who was the Countess Rivers, again, to apologise about it and say, you know, we know you've conformed, but we've got the orders that we have to take them away. But we know we showed good deference to you as a peer, as to your daughter. And, you know, we're not going to damage your property as such. So that was one really interesting example, just to show that they know that there was some care and consideration for that. So it wasn't, you have a sort of mythical thing, you know, that they're just that there's a very cold relationship. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think this is what's really fascinating about the English Revolutionary period in general, that it wasn't, you know, the old trope, to go back to like the Children of the New Forest book, you know, roundheads versus cavaliers. It's a lot more complicated. Yeah. It's a lot more grey. It's not black and white at all.
It's a horrible moment when, as a royalist, you realise that actually some of the parliamentarians had really good hair as well, and you don't know who you should be cheering on. It gets very confusing. But you touched on something there, which I think is really, really important. I'm so guilty of this, being very, very Anglo-centric when it comes to talking about this period. It wasn't just the English Civil War, it was a war of three kingdoms. So in terms of the treatment of Catholics being used to being sequestered and compounding and all of this, what about the Scottish Catholics? What about the Irish Catholics?
Well, this is where it gets really, really complicated. And I should add, for the book, I concentrated pretty much on the English Catholic perspective, just because that's where my sources were and everything. And it's something I haven't deliberately ignored as such, because book two, I'm planning to do looking at sequestration compounding across a much broader period. So from Reformation up to end of the 18th century, but including Scotland, Wales, Ireland and the colonies in America, you know, where Britain set camp in as such, because you even get sequestered property in this period in the colonies as well, in like Maryland and in the Caribbean. But I do touch upon it here and there, and it is really fascinating, because normally it's outside influences which are causing this. So when the Irish Rebellion happened and other events, you see this having repercussions in England towards English Catholics. And there's another example of, there's a Catholic called John Cowell, who is based in Sussex, and he tried to demonstrate his loyalty to Parliament during this period as an ardent parliamentarian supporter. And not only say, you know, I fed your soldiers when they came through Sussex and that sort of thing, but it was a fact that he gave £500 to fight against the Irish Catholic rebels in the beginning of the in the aftermath of the Irish Rebellion. And obviously he's an English Catholic, but he's trying to differentiate himself from the Irish Catholics. Like, he's saying, you know, I'm Catholic, but I'm a true loyal citizen. They're the naughty ones, pretty much.
The foreign ones, they're the ones you want to look out for.
Yeah, so I touched upon the situation a little bit in Wales and a tiny bit in Scotland, but I have to say it's mainly English-centric, just because that's where my sources were. And there's only so much you can do for your first book as such. but it is the long-term plan to take all this in and to see the patterns that form in this period. And what's, I mean, especially with the English Revolution period in general, it's such a different experience for them compared to what happened before the Civil War and what happened after 1660. And so it does deserve its own treatment in this book on its own. But yeah, but it's something that I definitely will take into consideration more. It's just there's only so much you can do for book one.
Very confusing.
I think the next question is kind of appropriate for a poor delinquent Catholic like myself, because I would be incredibly poor and I am a delinquent. So did Catholics try to forge relationships with the new regime, or were they actively involved in delinquency, get the right word, by default? And were any of them genuinely loyal to the Commonwealth, or were they doing it probably like I would have done, with fingers crossed behind their backs?
Oh, it's a very interesting question, because it, as you can imagine, it's a lot more complicated. What some people who study Amon period don't quite realise, you know, because obviously we know that there's different branches of Protestantism floating around in this period. So obviously, you know, you've got those who follow the Church of England, you've got the Socinians, you've got the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, what people normally call the Puritans, and though people don't normally like to use that term so much anymore. But what people don't realise is there's a lot of Catholic factions in this period as well. And this is sort of really taken off during the Appellant controversy at the turn of the 17th century, when Catholics were split on how to demonstrate their loyalty to Elizabeth I. So there were some camps who said, no, we want to swear an oath of allegiance to Elizabeth, but we want it on how we want to write it ourselves as such. And there were others like, nope, whatever. And it was also down to loyalty towards a bishop nomination as well, to have a Catholic bishop in England again. So it's a very complicated period as such. So this has caused some split. And with the Jacobean Oath of Allegiance in 1606, that complicated things further. So you had some Catholics who would swear, you know, the oath, probably practicing what they called mental equivocation. So you're swearing the oath, but you're adding in your head like sub clauses on that to try and, you know, conscientiously evade doing it, because, you know, obviously, because it's all down to conscience, isn't it? So you know, if you're adding like sub clauses in your head, then people would claim you're not taking the oath properly. And so there were some Catholics who actually omitted certain sections as well. So you see this happening a lot in the English Revolutionary period as well. So you had some Catholics who, you know, define themselves as recusants and you know, still consider the Pope as their, you know, their primate, you know, to swear allegiance to. But it also complicates the fact that there were Catholics who were quite happy as such to swear the oaths, probably either just because they want their property back, or because they saw themselves as Catholic, you know, loyal to the state, but in different ways. And you have a lot of Catholics in the late 1640s who are actually negotiating with the parliamentary regime for an alternative oath to swear called the Free Propositions. And they're doing this also with some certain members of the clergy, your Catholic clergy as well. And so, you know, it's a big front to try and get this like alternative oath and propositions for Catholic liberty of conscience and such under the new regime. So this is when Charles I hadn't even been put on trial at this point. But after the execution of Charles I in 1649 and the Rump Parliament being established and republicanism being established, you see a lot of different groups coming out again. So you had some Catholics who were royalists, who had either gone into exile with the exiled Stuarts, and were obviously planning to try and get the throne back, obviously because they think they support, you know, get the Stuarts back on the throne, they'll get their liberty of conscience or even toleration as such. Mm. But you had some Catholics at the same time who thought, well, actually, this is a new regime, we could actually try and get some new terms solved. So even though the three propositions have failed because the Pope refused to endorse it, there were some people who were trying to persuade Cromwell and other figures to give some sort of liberty of conscience. What's really fascinating is that there was an act passed, which is known as the Toleration Act. That's not its official title, that's what it's normally referred to. And that was passed in 1650. And while Catholics weren't included in the act, at the same time, they couldn't technically be punished for not going to church. They just couldn't practice their faith. And so Catholics were in a bit of a weird situation anyway, up until 1657, where they could be presented at Quarter Sessions of Assizes again for refusing to go to church before Catholicism as such. But you had figures like Sir Kenelm Digby, who I mentioned earlier, who had converted to Catholicism. He's a really fascinating figure, and who I actually did a whole section in Chapter 6 on, because he's just really interesting, because he seemed to get on well on both sides of the camps as such. Like, he was an ardent royalist during the English Revolution, went into exile with Henrietta Maria and the court, and he had his estates sequestered as well during this period. But he ends up coming, and he's part of this faction called the Black Loris, which is a minority Catholic faction headed by a man called Thomas White and others who are an intellectual group. So they're promoting philosophy, mathematics and other things, but they're also trying to get toleration for Catholics as such. And Thomas White writes this famous work called The Grounds of Obedience of Government in 1655, which was basically offering allegiance and loyalty to Cromwell, but on certain terms. So basically saying, we'll give you loyalty, but if we find that you're acting tyrannously, we can withdraw that loyalty. So, which doesn't go down very well with Cromwell, and that doesn't go down well with Charles II either when he comes back after 1660, because Thomas White ends up going to exile. So Kenelm Digby is part of this group, but despite that, he comes back to England in the early 1650s, and he gets on incredibly well with Cromwell, like almost like friendship levels of relationship with Cromwell. And yeah, Cromwell's dining with Catholic peers during the 1650s when a Jesuit priest gets executed and hung, drawn and quartered. He actually let the body be sewn back together, the four pieces, and send it back to France for burial. Because
that's nice. That's lovely.
Charlie's got a problem with Cromwell, so you can hear the sarcasm in her voice.
No, I completely understand. Cromwell's a very...
we killed him, but we killed him back
up. I think probably the nicest way to say about Cromwell is he's a bit of a Marmite character. You either love him or you hate him, sort of thing.
Yeah, but he's fun to argue with people about. So Kenelm Digby, I mean, he just sounds like he really is such an interesting character, isn't he?
Yeah, and the thing is, when Charles II comes back to the throne in 1660 and Henrietta Maria comes back, so he stays in England for a couple of years back in Somerset House, Kenelm Digby is hired up again to be Chancellor of her household. So he's managed to so that's why he had to be in the book, because, you know, he managed to float in there on all these different camps while also trying to get his property back, but also trying to pledge loyalty to and try and get support from Cromwell in his period, but also at the same time still being quite charismatic enough to be brought back into the Stuart fold after the Restoration. So he's absolutely fascinating as a figure.
Yeah. Is his brother George Digby, who becomes Earl of Bristol, are they those Digbys?
No, this is the problem. I mean, I think this is a problem when you've got the same surname. I don't think he is, because Digby was a convert. Another convert, so he may be like a distant branch. There's probably going to be someone who's going to correct me afterwards on here. George Digby was a convert, so I know that much, and he was, as you say, the Earl of Bristol. Mm. And he attacks actually the Earl of Clarendon in the 1660s for many other things. And people say, well, why are you attacking? You know, you're a reputed papist. Why enough are you doing this sort of thing? So again, complicated periods. Yeah, it's just absolutely fascinating. So I think the best thing to take away from that is that there's so many different Catholic factions floating around trying to negotiate an alternative, you know, form of toleration for Catholics or liberty of conscience for Catholics, that we can't just say that Catholics are all singing on the same hymn page, because they're not. they're all singing on very different hymn pages and hoping one of them will succeed in the end.
Gosh, you've moved us on very nicely to our next question by mentioning the Earl of Clarendon, who is a very big figure. So what happens to sequestration after the Restoration, and what did that mean for Catholics? Because I'm guessing surely King Charles II comes back and he says, I'm going to do my best to make things better for families that had helped him in some ways.
Yeah, and again, it's all very complicated, because I think Charles before Charles II comes back to England, because he lands back in England late May 1660, and he's invited back a couple months before, he issues this document called the Declaration of Breda for the Netherlands, where he's actually promising liberty of conscience to all his subjects, and that's including Catholics. And I think he genuinely wanted this declaration. He wanted liberty of conscience for his subjects. I genuinely do think he did want that. But as you can imagine, so many different factors at play. You see all the laws that existed under Elizabeth and James I being brought back to Catholics as soon as he comes back to Britain, because Parliament passes that, you know, all the laws before the Civil War come back against Catholics. And so Catholics are being presented and sequestered again for residency, as you can imagine.
Not again.
But back on the old system. And this is, so you start seeing it all returning back to that. I mean, this is something to add to listeners as well. During the Civil War and interregnum periods, all the documents are in English. Yeah. Beforehand, they're all in Latin, legal Latin. All reverts back to legal Latin after 1660.
Oh, my goodness. So, of course, that's partly what has made this such an attractive period for you to study.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a bit of Latin, a bit rusty, but you can find the terms like recusancy. It's like, yeah, this is all the Catholic stuff. It's also quite a good way of knowing what's all about cows. The amount of document recusancy roles is all involving cows.
That is absolutely hilarious. I mean, I've seen from this period, you know, that we're going into, the number of times that Charles tried to push for toleration and the Declaration of Indulgence, and every time it would get thrown out, and it would always tie in with some little flare up of dissent, either from Anglicans or from hardly ever from Catholics. It's mostly ever from Anglicans.
Yes, it's the fifth monarchists and those groups. Yes, it's not the Catholics. You know, there's always rumours that there's, you know, 200 papists up north who are getting ready to rise up. There's been rumours floating around, like in Stony Stratford or something like that. And yeah, so when you have like the Conventicle Act and other acts passed through during this period, it's targeting Catholics again. But he doesn't. So there are some Catholics who I looked at in case studies, and I think you see this more in the conclusion where I talk about the ones, you know, how do they all fare? And again, complicated, mixed picture. So you have people like the I forgot what the name was, John Arundel, the Arundel family, for example. He did quite well, so he was definitely supporting the Royalist cause during the English Revolutionary period, though he does conform and then, you know, to Parliament and things like that. He gets to become Master of the Horse, which obviously is quite a big prominent position in the 1660s. Whereas people like the Constable family, who didn't fare very well, kept proclaiming their innocence, that they were, you know, loyal to Parliament, you know, they kept being suspected of royalism. They were allowed to hunt game, but yeah, they didn't do financially very well out of it. But they managed to get their estates pretty much back, so that's always a good thing. Because I talk about in the book as well about the role of sequestration agents during this period, which you start to see the roots forming in 1640s, 1650s, and it really takes off by the end of the 17th century, where lawyers become a much more bigger thing for Catholics trying to protect their estates. And some Catholics do okay, some Catholics don't. It all depends on how they are, what their influences are, you know, and their importance as such as well, and also how useful they have been as well during this period. So Catholics could be presented again for recusancy and everything like that. But I suppose the question really to think about really is was it any worse? It depends on the family and whether you got your estates back. By and large, because I mostly looked at gentry cafes, because after 1645, if you had property in the estate worth more than £200, you're going to get targeted. Anything under, no. So basically, you're targeting the ones who could afford it. Mm. So by and large, I think they didn't know better or worse, but I think it was slightly better for them in the long run. But I suppose we're going back to the old system meant that they knew, they were going back to just, you know, the regular, oh, I didn't go to church, here's my fine, here's my receipt, that sort of thing as well.
Oh, do you think they're a bit of a cash cow for parliaments, various parliaments, not necessarily just in the Civil War? Do you think it was just, you know, we need to fill up the coffers, go after the Catholics again?
Yeah, and it's a good way to show the people if there's concern that Catholics, you know, are potentially building up unrest or something. We're reinforcing the Jacobean and Elizabethan laws. We're playing our part. We're reissuing the laws. We're going to get more people being presented. And you see this constantly throughout the 17th century and also in the 18th century, even in 1720s, 1730s, because I've already started the preliminary research into this. So I've done a bit for Ireland and for England for up to the 18th century. So it will be done. Ireland and Scotland and Wales will be included, but obviously COVID. So you still, even in the 1720s, 1730s, seeing the Jacobean Elizabethan laws being referenced for Catholics being presented. And it's always during times where there's been some unrest. So like in 1720s, it's because, you know, you had the Jacobite rebellions. It's like, oh, right, we better start bringing them through. We better start punishing them again. Obviously, using the Jacobite threat as a reason, a justifiable big reason to present them.
I often found that with some of the Catholic families I'm looking at, if they were deemed to be no threat, then they were just allowed to get on with it. Like the Earl of Berkshire, who Parliament decided was so stupid, he was no threat, so they let him keep his house. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing, isn't it? It's like there was a special exemption, but even by Parliament, of the Earl of Auburn's in the 1640s, because even they stated that, even though he's Catholic, he actually went to Ireland for us to fight against the Irish Catholic rebels. Yeah. Therefore, we're especially exempting him because he's actually shown true loyalty to us, sort of thing. I love the Earl of Berkshire example. That's absolutely great.
Alice, this has been so, so interesting for a 20th century historian, especially. I've been sitting at the edge of my seat, listening to the sequestration. I still can't say the word now. I'm starting to panic with that word, especially for someone who is Catholic and having to listen to what these people went through. It's absolutely terrifying. So I'm so glad you've come here and explained all of this and actually given us something positive that has come out of it, even though there was quite a lot of negativity. There is something that did come out that was good. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been so much fun to talk about and geek about it as well.
And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget to head to our bookstore where you'll be able to pick up a copy of Eilish's book titled Catholics During the English Revolution, 1642 to 1660, Politics, Sequestration and Loyalty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look. Do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history. or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.